Please note, this podcast is not a substitute from seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. If it feels like no one understands your problems or cares to listen, if it feels like there is no one else in this world who has gone through what you have, if you feel like you're so close to giving up on your goals, your business, your ideal life, but still holding on, Cafe with Monica was made for you. I'll show you how to deal with the everyday and not so everyday situations that surface in the lives of millennials. By sharing my experiences and knowledge, I hope to inform, inspire, and provide solutions to problems that may seem out of reach. So grab your coffee or drink of choice and let's just talk about it. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm really excited to announce today's guest. Michael Shahan is a licensed marriage and family therapist in Kansas City, Missouri, and EMDR certified. Michael is passionate about working with others to get unstuck and to help them become the best version of themselves possible. I've asked Michael to chat with me today because he is an Enneagram whisperer. After listening to this episode, you're going to want to check out his IG, where he combines his knowledge as a therapist and the Enneagram to provide valuable insight. So, Michael, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, thanks for asking me to be here.
Well, I want you to tell my guests who may not be familiar with you a little bit about your journey, what brought you to where you are now, and I'm curious, like, what made you decide to become a therapist?
Yeah, I'll try to shorten this. it was a sophomore year of high school, I think. I was reading a book by a guy, kind of his memoirs. It's a book called Blue Like Jazz. Basically, he was telling a story about his life, and part of it had to do with sort of failed relationships. And then he said, and remember in the story, I haven't gone back and looked at this forever, but he basically said he was having failed relationships and he went to see a therapist, and he found out with that therapist, through that therapist, that something about he had a hard time accepting love, so he couldn't give love. Or something like that. And something clicked in him and he was able to shift like how we did relationships forever after that and be way more healthy. And I remember reading that and thinking like, I don't know what that is, but I want to do that. Like, I want to help people, that phrase kind of help people get unstuck or be the best version of themselves just struck me then. And I've never been able to forget it. that's kind of the shortened version. And then went to school for family studies and then graduate school for marriage and family therapy. And I didn't know what it looked like to help people get unstuck at that point, right? Like, I didn't know I was going to be a licensed marriage and family therapist. It took a long time to kind of find what degree I needed to do that, what that would look like in practice. But I mean, here I am. When was that? That was sophomore year of high school. So I'm like 15 years later or something like that, like doing it. And it's really, really cool. It's still the most incredible thing I could ever do.
That is so awesome. And are you originally from Missouri?
No, I'm from Tulsa, Oklahoma, actually.
Oh, okay. Okay. So I'm in Texas. So you're kind of close.
Yeah.
But I've always been, I've always been in Texas. So that's awesome.
Okay.
And for LMFTs in Kansas, do you also have to do like 3,000 hours, 1,500?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's kind of.
Yeah, it was, I think it was 3,000 and then like 1,500 of them were, or something, I think were direct client hours and the other were sort of office experience training, professional hours, I think is what it's called. And then I had to do supervision, like a certain ratio of supervision per client. I was doing hours of supervision a week. Just because I got licensed so quickly after I graduated. You have to be able to do it between 2 and 5 years, and I did it just like a month after 2 years. And so I squeezed it in quick because I had a lot of clients really fast. So it was awesome.
That is awesome. I'm recently licensed.
Cool.
So it'll be a year in August. So
Same year, actually.
Really? Mm-hmm, yeah. And something that I really admired you. So when I started doing my Instagram account, you were one of the people that were showing up as pre-licensed because I was also showing up like pre-licensed. I really wanted to kind of get into my niche, which is entrepreneurs, specific Latinx entrepreneurs. And so I love seeing, you know, therapists really show up before they get fully licensed and kind of figuring out what their niche is. I remember when you first started your Instagram and now you're like, you're getting there, like you're getting followers.
yeah, it's fun and terrifying.
Right. It seems like it's a lot of responsibility. But I think you're providing some valuable, valuable, tangible tips there.
Thank you.
Because I haven't seen a therapist talk a lot about the Enneagram. Mm. I know I'm obsessed with it whenever I was first introduced to it. Yeah. I had my husband do his Enneagram. And yes. Sometimes we'll be like, oh, that's such a... So I'm a 3. And he's a 7.
That's what I guessed.
Yeah. And he's a 7. And so sometimes we'll be like, oh, you're such a 7. Oh, you're such a 3.
3 and 7. That's a lot of high energy couple there. That's got to be intense.
It is. It is. You know moving. It. You know it. So there's always a lot of compromise in our family. But so one of the questions that I wanted to ask you is tell us about the Enneagram for those who don't know what this great resource is and how you first found out about it.
Cool. Yeah. So I'll give a little nutshell thing that I usually give my little elevator pitch, I guess, for the Enneagram. Because I talk about it so much, I feel like I slowly developed this. The Enneagram is like a personality test, but it's way more. So you've heard of maybe the Myers-Briggs or the DISC or the, I don't know, there's all sorts of other assessments. Those most every time are based on what you do. That's how it defines you into categories. The Enneagram is based on why you do what you do. So it's divided up into 9 different numbers, and each number is, so you kind of get labeled with a number, which is your number, your Enneagram number. And what that tells you is not what you do or what your behaviors are as directly as something like the Myers-Briggs would, but it tells you why you do what you do. Each Enneagram number has a core motivation and a core fear. And the theory is that everything you do sort of runs from that. So you can have different numbers people of the same number do different things at times, but they're still motivated by the same thing. Or you can have different numbers do a similar thing, but they're motivated by different motivations, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, that makes total sense.
And it's just all about your unconscious motivations. And those are hard to get at. It takes a lot of work. Because, I mean, they're called unconscious motivations for a reason, because they're usually unconscious. We're just kind of acting from them, working off of them, living from them without even realizing it a lot of times. And so that segues into why I love the Enneagram and where I heard about it. It's just such a perfect therapy tool, because that's what therapy is. It's kind of making the unconscious conscious. And that's what the Enneagram does. It gives you a map for all these things about yourself that you may not have realized. So I actually heard about the Enneagram before I graduated. I don't remember when it was. Somebody asked me to take a test. No, I heard it on a podcast somewhere, and I heard they had brief explanations. I was like, oh, I think I'm this number. And I thought it was a 7, just judging by the short bit that they talked about. Uh-huh. It's like, okay, I'm a 7. And then just kind of didn't really do anything with it for a couple months. And then someone is like, here, take this test. It'll tell you which number you are. And then I tested as a 2. But it wasn't until about a year later that I realized that I wasn't a 2. It is interesting because it can take a long time to find out your number, because the number that I am, I'm a 9. They can do a lot of things that 2s do. They can both be people pleasing. They can both sort of tend to deny their own needs. They can both tend to be pretty warm and friendly, but they do it for very different reasons. And so until I was able to dig into the reasons why I was doing these things, it was hard to really gauge what my number was, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I actually had a client, one of my very first clients ever as a therapist, say, hey, I check this podcast out. They talk about each one of these numbers in detail. And first, I thought the Enneagram was kind of cool, but I wasn't a huge fan because it was like 9 different numbers. I didn't like how restrictive that felt. Mm-hmm. Like I, as a DSM diagnosis, giving clients diagnosis, I hate doing that. I don't do that unless I need to for insurance. And there's hundreds of diagnoses that I could give clients, but I still hate doing it because it feels so pathologizing, puts them in a mm-hmm. box, makes them see themselves a certain way, makes me see them a certain way. And so I was like, I don't want to do that with 9 different numbers for each person, for people, right? But then I heard this podcast that my client recommended. This guy gave an example. He said, if your Enneagram number is like a color, let's say the number 9 is like the color blue. He's like, there are hundreds or thousands of shades of blue, but they are all still blue. And that clicked with me. I was like, oh, okay. You can look so different and there's still like a bluishness to it, but it can look very different. Does that make sense?
No, yeah, that makes total sense. And I used to think that I was a 1. Like at first I got both scores of a 1 and a 3. And then I'm like, maybe I'm a one because I'm really super, similar. Yeah, like a super organized, love systems.
Organized, to-do lists, systems, processes, organizing things. Yeah. Those are both very similar.
Yeah, but then when you asked why I do things,
total three. Wow, okay.
Total three, yeah.
It's hard work to see that. Usually when you see your own number, it can get really uncomfortable. When my wife is a one, and she can be very blunt, very direct in a loving way. but sometimes it doesn't feel loving because she's just very direct. When I told her about the Enneagram, I was like, I'm a two. You should read about this. And she gave it about a day and she was like, so I was looking at this and no offense, but it says that one of the main characteristics for a two is that they're generous and you're not super generous. And I was like, luckily I was in a good place in life where I could hear that. And she said, I think you're a nine because you say this kind of stuff all the time. You always talk about being at peace and being comfortable and everybody getting along. You always talk about that stuff. And I was like, oh, that's really uncomfortable, but I think you're right. I'm really stingy. I'm not as generous as a two. And then I looked into a nine and I had this sort of, they say this happens usually, there's kind of an ick factor when you really arrive at what your number is. I was like, oh, I don't want to be that number. That feels gross. Just because our ego patterns are so strong, our personality is so strong doing those things, it doesn't want to sort of get caught. It doesn't want to be seen. And so when you start to see it, see the patterns of your personality, it can get really uncomfortable for a while.
Yeah. So give us kind of like...
I know I'm selling it really well.
No, you're good. So give us kind of like the rundown of what each number is. Like if you can give us the Cliff Notes version.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to do a lot of injustice because they're so nuanced, right? But I'll give the sort of main pieces of every number really quick as I can. So the one... So that some people put names to the numbers. So intentionally the system was created without names because if you say a name, like the three is the achiever. If you say the achiever, immediately somebody's mind is gonna go to certain, like their own definition of the achiever. Mm-hmm. And so there's intentionally numbers that don't have any sort of characteristics to them. But, so just try to think of that, but also I'll name them because it helps to help them stick, I think. So the one is the, sometimes called the reformer or the perfectionist. Their biggest fear is that they're somehow bad or immoral or corrupt. And so their biggest motivation is to do the right thing or to be good. Mm-hmm. And so they can be very perfectionistic, huge rule followers. They can be very inflexible. They're really good at seeing what's wrong around them and they want to fix it. They want to fix the things that are wrong around them and they want to fix the thing in themselves. So much so that other people can see them as very critical and unappreciative, but they can be appreciative. They're just, their mind zeroes in on what needs fixed more than anybody else. And that can be a great thing, or it can be a really unhealthy thing. That's one of my favorite parts of the Enneagram as I go through this. Your biggest strength can also be your like Achilles heel, mm-hmm. if it's turned up too high, which is just fascinating to me. Like your biggest weakness isn't necessarily a bad thing. It can be shifted to an amazing strength that's created something amazing in you. So the two is called sometimes called the helper. Their biggest fear is that they are unlovable. Is that kind of who they are at their core is unlovable. And so they tend to, and this is really hard to see in twos, they tend to help other people so that they can be loved in return. So they want to be loved and they want, so they tend to help other people or adopt a very cheerful, happy personality, very giving, mm-hmm. very sacrificing of their own needs so that other people will sort of love them, kind of.
Yeah.
And that's what they can tend to do. But it can turn into manipulation. It can turn into inauthenticity, fearing that people don't love them, just love their help. So it can almost become a self-defeating cycle. Every number has their own self-defeating cycle that they can sort of dig themselves into. Like their attempt to solve the problem can actually make the problem worse, which is just super unfair, if you ask me. It's super messed up. And then you have the three, who is sometimes called the achiever. Their biggest fear is that they have no value or worth. And so they tend to hustle and work really hard to achieve and be seen as valuable. They can tend to unconsciously turn into like a social chameleon and sort of become what other people expect them to become, become successful in the ways that other people expect them to, and they can kind of lose sight of themselves and who they really are. Is this getting uncomfortably close?
Preach.
My people.
Preach. Yes. My clients and me, basically.
Oh, sure. I spoke at a Greater Entrepreneurship Week in Kansas City last November, I think is what it was. And I my guess is, and I did a poll and it was like lots and lots of people there were threes.
Yeah.
Because that's the kind of place that attracts them, right? The entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. They're wanting to be successful, they're very fast moving people. They have idea after idea, very forward thinking. They can tend to sort of numb their own emotions in the moment and feel them before or after something happens in a way. But yeah. And then you have the four, which is called the individualist sometimes. Their biggest fear is that they have no identity. That kind of who they are, their core is, there's really nothing there, or that they're not. Two, three, and four all struggle with identity in a specific way. But four is the fear that they don't have any identity and they sort of have to be unique or special to find a sense of identity. So two, three, and four, the two wants to be a rescuer, the four wants to be a rescuee, and the three in the middle don't need no rescuing. They could do it. I think that's a good way to frame those three, right? The fours want to be rescued and unique and seen as special because that can kind of soothe that fear in them that they don't have a sense of identity or they're not very special. Mm-hmm. They can feel very abandoned a lot of times. And they can be, they're very, very emotionally intelligent. They feel things more than any other number, fours do. Sometimes too much, honestly. They can get stuck in their feelings instead of moving forward, which is kind of, can be the opposite of threes in a certain way. and then you have the five, who's they call them the observer. They're the most heady type, which is so interesting because the fours are the most emotional type. And right next to them are the five, which is the headiest of heady types.
Wow.
Their biggest fears are being overwhelmed or incompetent. And so they're driven to learn. Just learn new things. They sort of pull inward to learn so that they can kind of protect themselves from anything that comes up so they can be prepared. And that can look like a lot of very withdrawing. They can look super introverted at times, like the sort of stereotype of like the absent-minded college professor who just talks and sometimes or then their own head kind of can seem aloof and spacey, but they really, their heads are going at a million miles an hour. Their thoughts are just going like crazy. And they notice so many things that you and I usually don't or even know that they're noticing. It's wild. And you have a six, which is called a loyalist. The six is interesting because they can look very, very, it's hard to talk about one six. You can have multiple sixes that look very different compared to other numbers for some reason. Mostly around the biggest six is the biggest fear of six is having no support or security. Mm. And so they can either look to sort of the structure in society and people who look like they know what they're doing and put like all of their trust in them. Because it's like they feel very incompetent and capable of providing their own security or safety. And so they can reach out to others. So it's like they're fear driven. And so they can either fight, flight, or freeze in a way. They can kind of run away from themselves. They can freeze and just do what anybody tells them to do. Or they can sort of buck up to the fear. And it's called a counterphobic six. They can look really intense and they can put themselves in dangerous situations. And they can trust like nobody and nothing. And it all comes from the same place of fear, wanting to sort of prove that they're not afraid by being big and by being intense.
Wow.
So they can look so different. You can have the mildest, meekest person ever who's a six, or you can have the biggest, like destructive, intense person at times, and they're also a six. It's really wild to see. Sixes are often misunderstood. They're called the loyalist because once they find someone or something they can trust, they are just all in. They can be the most loyal friends ever, almost to a fault at times. you have the seven. Sometimes they're called the adventurous. Their biggest fear is of being trapped in pain or discomfort. And so they are very forward-thinking as well, meaning they, because of their fear of being trapped in pain, they're always thinking about the next thing. They love new options. They love new exciting things. They love new ideas, new adventures. Because so like the five can pull inward because of fear of things externally. The seven moves outward for fear of things internally. I don't know if that makes sense. They're afraid of their own sort of inner landscape and the pain that could come up and they don't want to feel their own grief. And so they kind of are always moving on to the next thing to avoid that. And then you have the eight, who's called the challenger. They're probably the most intense people on the Enneagram. They can look like this counterphobic six that I mentioned earlier, but they're actually, they're way more productive than the counterphobic six. Their biggest fear is of being controlled or sort of being controlled or weak. And so their life, their biggest motivation is to be strong and independent and to be tough. There's this song, this artist did these songs about each Enneagram number, and there's a line in the Enneagram 8 song that says, "I will break these bones to make them better." And that is just such an 8 thing, such an 8 thing. Like, I will do that. My man, they're just really, really intense people. My twin brother's an 8, and some of my favorite clients are 8s. I have a lot of female 8s in my office because female 8s in our culture are very not liked, very intimidating people to men, to fragile men. They like stereotypically our culture can see men as 8s. Like men should be 8s and women should be 2s is the kind of like the helper, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you have a woman who, a female who has these kind of 8 tendencies of wanting to be powerful and take the lead and get things done, they can be very, especially in like evangelical circles and stuff like that, can be very, have a lot of shame that comes with those desires in them. So I think, I partly think that's why I have a lot of female 8s as clients, unfortunately. but yeah, they're very intense people. They do a lot. They're very forward thinking as well. They have a lot of energy. And then you have the 9, which is what I am. They can be, their biggest fear is of being disconnected or kind of loss. And so whether that's with relationships, with themselves, with the things around them. And so the biggest desire is to be at peace, to be comfortable, to be kind of relaxed, to feel at ease in their bodies and around them, to have no conflict. Because for 9, they can kind of think internally that if there's conflict, then this relationship's, I'm going to lose it. Or, right, so they can kind of pull back and not share their own opinions and kind of mute themselves in a lot of ways so that they don't cause conflict. But what happens is they actually become disconnected from themselves in doing that, which is that sort of, they work themselves into their own fear. So. Wow. And it makes sense why I'm a therapist, because I just want everybody to get along, right? I just want everybody to be happy with each other. And what I didn't realize when I first, in grad school, I remember realizing just how much conflict I have to sit through with clients for them to get sort of to a more healthy place. And I remember thinking like, oh man, can I do this? Like, I want them to get along, and that's what sort of brought me into this, for people to be okay and the best version of themselves mm-hmm. to feel okay. But am I okay? Like, can I sit with them in the process? Because usually the sitting with them is really hard. It takes a lot of breaking down of themselves and their relationships to kind of discover that better part of themselves. But I found that it's very much worth it. Yeah, that's a quick run through.
You know, all 9, like, I'm just blown away.
That's a short version as I could get. I could talk so long about this.
Oh
stuff.
My gosh, you need to do a course, man. But
I actually I'm working, we can talk about the end if you want to, but I'm doing actually a course for therapists. I'm creating it now, who want to learn how to use the Enneagram with their clients. I'm really excited because there's nothing out there like that I've found.
Yeah, so, which kind of segues to our question. It's how does the Enneagram help you with your clients? How do you incorporate it, use it?
Yeah, I remember I first used it just to really stay curious about clients. Like, right, like some clients knew what it was. Some clients I'd share with them about it and they'd go read about it. And the first thing I noticed how it was helpful in the therapy room was the Enneagram at its best helps you be compassionate for yourself and for other people. Sort of helps you, like, oh, that's why I do what I do. Like, not because I'm like bad or weak or I shouldn't be ashamed of it. Like that's, I have this core fear, and when it operates, that's what happens. Like, or even for my wife, I remember, so my wife and I can be very different, even though we're right next to each other. When I learned about this, about ones, and had this fear of not being good, and so they have to do everything right and they can't rest. And it's like, the joke I always make my wife, it's like, you're not going to be happy until we have like 2 years of emergency funds for every one of our categories in our budget. You won't go on vacation until you've saved up this much. It's like, it's always work, work, work. And once we're secure and we're doing it right, then we can play or go on vacation, or we can't relax until the house is fully clean. And it's like, for me, I was like, can we just like relax and take it easy and just have a good time? And I used to, there was a lot of frustration with that. Like, why are you like pushing and driving so hard? Like, don't you want to relax? But when I learned that so much of that was being driven by this fear of her, of like not doing well enough, not doing the right thing, not right. It's like, oh, that makes so much sense. Like, I just softened so much toward her when I realized that. And I've seen that in couples. And when I do couples work at the Enneagram, and I've seen that in people toward themselves, like, that's why my husband does that. Like, it's not because he hates me. It's just because he's afraid of this. And I can have a lot more compassion for that. So just understanding that it creates in people and in people's relationships is huge. And I just, when I first use it, I use it a lot to be curious about people. Like, I've heard this in a podcast that threes tend to do this. Is that true for you? And just like, and they were able to share their experience in like almost a more specific way when I was able to ask direct questions like that. And the things that I've learned since then, oh man, we could talk so long. Like, how there's each number has a specific social stance, and that whether you are aggressive, whether you are complacent, or whether you are withdrawing in your relationships, and that helps. And I could talk forever about each number has certain tendencies to do this, and it helps them kind of map out, like, yeah, so much of therapy is helping people understand why they do what they do, have awareness of it, because you can't shift anything unless you know why you're doing what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so the Enneagram Absolutely. Sort of flips the lights on in the dark room that you've been wandering around in your life, knocking in the furniture without realizing it, kind of flips the lights on and lets you see where things are so you can maneuver around it and work better with it than you could have before.
Yeah. And I just think it's just a great personal development tool. And what I really liked about it is just showing how there are healthy ways around your number and unhealthy ways of things that you do.
Yes. Yeah.
And so like, that's what me and my husband always like, okay, you know, let's kind of sit and have a check-in to see if we're having like our unhealthy tendencies, especially when COVID first started and we're like, you know, the three in me was like, I need to get all this stuff done. And, you know, and then he was like, lunchtime, let's go and chat. Let's like, or because he wanted to avoid the thing that he didn't want to do. It helped us honestly set healthy boundaries around each other. And I thought that's a great way that we incorporated the Enneagram in our relationship. So one of the, there was one graphic on Instagram that really just stood out to me, and I was sharing it to, so I don't see couples, but I see individuals, and we work through relationship issues at an individual level, and they usually have a couple therapists. But one of the graphics that you showed was how each Enneagram type shows up in relationships.
Yeah.
I would love for you to tell me a little bit about how each person shows up in a relationship.
Because
I know that the Enneagram Institute, I think it was the Enneagram Institute. They kind of show compatibility. Like, you can see who is compatible with what. And, you know, the minute that we got into this recording, you were like, oh, a three and a seven, like me and my husband, it's intense. And that's exactly what it says. It's like, well, I mean, it can work, but y'all really have to have those check-ins.
Because it
can be intense. So I would love for you to tell us a little bit about how each person kind of shows up within their number in a relationship.
Yeah. Let's do that. You don't have the post with me, but I mean, the post just, I mean, which I mean, I can still speak to it. It still comes from head. So, so first of all, before we even talk about any of that, I want to say, because people ask this question a lot, there is no such thing, in my opinion, as a number pairing that's doomed.
Right.
Or a number pairing that's the best. That's not how it works. That's not the Enneagram is. It's healthy people, healthy relationships. So I don't care what your numbers are. If you are healthy people, your relationship will be healthy. It can look very different. It can definitely have different strengths and different weaknesses. But there's no such thing as like a doomed relationship. These numbers never going to work. There's certain numbers that might be more difficult at times because they can kind of tend to deal with things in the exact opposite way of each other. And so that can create lots of interesting conflict. But there's no such thing as like a failed pairing. That's not going to work.
Absolutely.
Sorry, you going to add something?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, yeah, like when we looked into it, it was like, how can we do better with each other in our number, right? Sure. Instead of seeing it like, okay, how compatible are we?
I think that's the wrong question to ask.
Yeah. That's so true. You know, I think people, if anybody's listening to it, is understanding that. If you go and look at your Enneagram number, don't say no to on a date for someone. Oh, that guy's a one. I can't date him.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
We're doomed from the beginning. It's just not going to work out.
Yes. Cause you are so much more than your number. Everybody is, right? And that's what people can sort of just sink themselves in, I'm just a this, I'm just a three, so I do this, which is kind of the exact opposite of what the Enneagram is trying to do, in my opinion. And it really frustrates me when I see people do that. Like, it's about getting, stepping out of your personality, not digging yourself further into it and identifying with it. It's about de-identifying from your personality and doing something different. So relationships, let's start with one again. So ones can tend to be, they can come off as overly critical of their partner or any relationships because they're so good at like, why would you, they can almost think like, why would you not want to know what you're doing wrong? Because if you know what you're doing wrong, I asked my wife that several months ago. I was like, does it confuse you when people don't want to know that they're doing wrong? And she looked at me like she didn't even understand my question. She was like, why do people not want to know? And I was like, wait, hold on. You don't know. She's like, yeah, why would people not want to know? Because you can't improve. You can't fix it if you don't know. And that's just the mind of a one. She's just so, and it can come off to their relationships as overly critical, or like, it can be frustrating to people. Like, you don't care about the good that I'm doing. Like, they see the good that you're doing. That's just not what comes out of their mouth. Because for them, that's not what's important. For good or for bad, right? And they can do amazing things. My wife has helped me. I wouldn't be not be nearly the person I am today without her. She has just pushed me to be better and to improve and to stick to my word at times in life. Like, I would never would have done it myself. So it's been so amazing to have her believe so much about myself that I never believed, my capability to do things. So that's been really, really cool. So that's one of the biggest strengths, I think. A two, they can be so helpful and so generous in their relationships, all the relationships. They'll drop whatever they're doing to help a friend just immediately. Sometimes, however, that can turn into a, like, I do this for you, why don't you do this for me? And there can be resentment that builds. Ooh. And they can be very hurt by friends who don't, they can be very sensitive people. And they're very sensitive and tuned to the people's needs around them, but they can tend to shove down their own needs. And so, which can build to long-term resentment, and it can build to not sharing what they really think or really feel about something. But yeah, that's a two. They can be really, really helpful, really generous. It's wild. So my Enneagram two clients that can come to my office, it's happened before. And I had a really heavy session right before. And they're just like, what's wrong? Are you okay? And they just know. It's unbelievable. I'm like, oh, that means so much. This session's about you. But that means so much to me that you see that. they're so in tune with that. And it can be really great to be in a relationship with the two, just for that, right? You can feel so seen and so helped. The three in relationship can be very goal-driven, right? In a similar way that ones can. They can be very structured, like, here, let's do this. I want to do this around the house, or I want to do this with you. And if they say they're going to do something for you, they're probably going to do it. And you can have a lot of trust, I think, with threes. And they can be very encouraging. They can see the threes in my life before I ever saw myself as almost worthy of putting my thoughts and ideas out on Instagram. Like, there's this part of me as a nine that's like, my ideas aren't that important anyways. Who wants to hear this? The threes in my life were like, what you have to say matters, and we're going to help you get it out there because it's great. And it's like, wow. And it just months and months and months of that, I started to believe it. And it was really, it was so great to have the threes in my life kind of encouraging me to do that and helping me even in practical ways that I could never have the skills for. But also threes can be, they can lose themselves in a relationship, not know who they are, not know who, what they want. They can be so blind to it because they can just sort of, and they can kind of morph to whoever they're with and sort of become what the other person wants to become. And they can kind of not give themselves, yeah, in that way in a relationship. And they can be kind of emotionally flat at times during difficult things. Can be, fours can hold space for any emotion you can throw at them, for the most part. Anything. It's unbelievable. So I have two friends, two of my male therapist friends that are my favorite people ever are fours. And it's just, when I'm having like a mental emotional breakdown, I can call them and just cry or be angry, and they are just ready for it. Like, I remember I was so angry, and I called him. I was like, I'm so angry, and I hate that I'm angry. He's like, be angry. Tell me how angry you are, and just welcomes everything. And it's so comforting and so helpful to process. And at the same time, they can be really hot or cold in their relationships, really intense, and then really pulling back, thinking they're great, thinking their relationship sucks, thinking that they suck, thinking that they're the best person ever. Very, very hot or cold. They can be unpredictable. They can kind of overdo their emotions at times. Like they can spend so much time in their emotions that they're not doing practical things they need to do. They can also be very sensitive people, like the twos can be hurt very easily. Fours are frequently misunderstood by all the, because it's a weird struggle. They can almost like being depressed and feeling sad. They can almost overdo that. They can almost take a sense of comfort in their own suffering, which most people just don't get. They can almost use like sadness and depression as a defense mechanism, which is just because it's so interesting.
I know. And then you have a whole post about defense mechanisms. Oh, I know I can probably talk about this whole thing. But anyway, relationships, yeah.
Yes, it's hardest to, fives, they can be very emotionally detached at times. Mm-hmm. They have this amazing ability to kind of shut off their own emotions in the moment. Just completely shut them off. And at the same time, that can provide lots of really, it can be very grounding people, right? Like it's like to be able to sort of, in the opposite way of before, they're like, if you need to not feel your emotions, or if you need to sort of have this wisdom that's kind of detached wisdom and logic from emotions, they can be really great at providing that. They're really great. They're very, very practical people. They are prepared for lots and lots of things. They're very knowledgeable at lots of things, and they have so much to give in that area in their relationships. It can be difficult for them to pivot in relationships quickly, like go from one thing to another or shift what they're doing quickly, because it can take them a long time to kind of, it's just hard for them to sort of hit the brakes and go the other direction anything really. Sixes in relationships, they can be so, so loyal. They can be some of the most grounded, loyal people you've ever met. Just sixes, when they're healthy, I can just breathe around them. Like, I don't know what it is. It's like, oh, I just trust you and I trust me when I'm around you. I don't know what this is, but this is just great being with you. They can just be so, such awesome people to have in your life. And at the same time, they can be very fear-based in a lot of what they do and how they react in relationships. They can very easily see, they can spend 90% of their energy thinking about the 10% of things that can go wrong. And it's like, and just that happens in relationships and around them, and they can be very frozen in what they do and how they move forward in relationships and in life because of that fear, kind of paralysis by analysis. A lot of times they can just get frozen. And they have a hard time trusting anybody. Sixes can have a hard time trusting their therapists, but once they do, they do. they can almost give them, and in relationships, sixes can almost over idealize or sort of see people as heroes, like hero worship kind of tendencies in relationships, which is unfair. And any relationship that's not at a peer level in like a couple relationship or a friendship that's sort of at this hierarchical relationship, then it can be unhealthy for both people in a lot of ways. The sevens can bring so much fun and energy and life to relationships, and it can be exciting and adventurous. At the same time, there can be difficulty committing to something, difficulty, and it's weird. Here's a great example really quick of how numbers can be different. So I know some sevens who just pack their calendars because they're so afraid of missing out and missing out on something, doing something fun. And so they just pack their calendars with all these things. But some sevens hate packing their calendars because, like, what if something better comes up? I don't want anything there and not be able to do that. I don't want to be held down from that commitment if something better comes up. And so it's coming from the same place and not wanting to miss out, but they can do very different things. Like then packing their calendar versus not wanting to put anything on their calendar. So they can just be free to do whatever. But sevens can be so forward moving that they can sort of leave their relationships behind, and people can be very left out by sevens because they're on the next idea, and people can feel left out and hurt and wounded by the seven who hasn't paid attention to them as much as they would like, or has put more importance on the next thing than their partner or their friend. Eights in a relationship can be some of the most protective, encouraging friends there are. So my brother is a twin. And when I told him about how I got chosen to do that entrepreneurship talk last fall, it was the first time I've done something like that. And I was like, dude, I'm super nervous. can't believe they picked me. And he was like, listen, man. He was like, you know that better than anybody else. You've blown me away so many times. Everybody's impressed with what you do. This is going to be the great, you deserve it. People are going to love it. It's just like these, I call them his love guns. They just come out blazing. And eights can be the most protective. They can be very justice oriented, protecting people who can't protect themselves. They spend a lot of energy fighting the good fight. But on the flip side of that, they can be so into being strong that they can really fear vulnerability in relationships, really fear coming close. They can terrify of having needs, of not being independent. And it can look like kind of keeping their closest people to them at arm's length emotionally. And people can they can get very angry very quickly, which is connected to the justice and all that stuff. So eights can be very intense and very exciting, like in a lot of ways, like sevens, but they can also be very emotionally cut off and guarded. And then nines can be the most affirming, accepting people. Like one of my best gifts as a therapist, and one of the easiest things is just like someone tells me like this horrible thing that they think they've done, and I'm just like, wow, makes sense. Of course you did that. Like, why would you not, given that situation? No judgment here. And it just so easily flows out of me. Like, I just get it and I understand, and I'm not going to judge you for it. I can just accept whatever you bring. And nines can definitely do that for their relationships. They can be encouraging and accepting and non-judging. But some of the biggest weaknesses of them in relationships for nines is they just run away from conflict. They never say what they want. They're never going to express their opinion. They will just apologize immediately to stop conflict. They can be run all over. They can withdraw from their friends and relationships a lot because they can kind of think in their heads, nines, like, I'm not worried of this. They don't like me anyway, so might as well not reach out. They can not reach out to their friends in a lot of ways, and then their friends can feel very left out, abandoned by them, which is crazy because nines hate feeling abandoned, and then they end up doing it to other people. Every number, same thing. They all have their own, they sort of end up taking out their biggest fear on other people in subtle ways. But yeah, that's the nine relationship. It can be very passive, withdrawing, non-active. So that's that. That's as quick as I could do it. I probably let that out. But on my post on Instagram, me and Enneagram Ashton sort of collaborated, did that together, and then came up with those, had a couple hour phone call and came up with those and talked about them and discussed them and then put them out, and they're on both of our pages. But I think it's a really cool resource for people.
Yeah, that is so awesome. Yeah, I really love that. And I think I'm just waiting. I mean, he's going to come out with a therapist at every number, like how you are as a therapist, as a one.
That's what I'm doing. I'm working on that. I'm actually working on that. Yes. Because they all have different strengths.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm really excited about that. And so I think it would just be so great for you to, I'm so excited for you to do that course. When do you feel, when are you going to be like ready to release it? Or do you feel like it's kind of like a 2020 project not coming out to 2021?
No, it's definitely this year. I think toward the end of the summer is what we're shooting for. I have the modules outlined. I have sort of how I want to do it and the content. I have sort of wanted to do a pilot group, the very first group, and then record live Q&As and have those as part of the course. So if anybody wants to be in the pilot group, I'll get excited because I'll be asking for people to do that till the end of December, I think.
Oh, I love that.
But I'm very, very excited about that. That's something I've been working on for quite a long time.
Oh, that is so exciting. I'm so glad that we connected. So there is one question that I'd like to ask everybody that I bring on the show. And that is, what is one thing that you wish people would talk about more?
Oh, let's see. I think this is what I want to answer. I want people to talk about their own unconscious motivations more. And that kind of fits with it, like sort of why we do what we do. Because we are all so reactive in our day-to-day lives. And we can be so hurtful to people without realizing it. Hurtful to ourselves, hurtful to people we love. But I think when people can, I think people wish people talk more about why they do what they do. And talk about their exploration kind of their own inner landscape. And like, this is why I do this. And when I do this, I react this way. And I think that's why. And so that just creates such healthy people, I think. talking about the awareness of their own inner self and their own inner work, because that just, I don't know if there's a concise way to put that,
but
not necessarily a huge topic, like a global topic, but like an individualized kind of like, I wish everybody talked more about why they do what they do in conversation with each other. Because those conversations are so rich and so wonderful and so affirming. Yeah, just in hard conversations with therapists and coworkers, it's like, oh man, when you say this to me, this comes up. And then, and I think this is why, and thank you for sharing that with me. How did you react when I said that? I don't know, just conversations like that are so honest and so vulnerable. And so it creates so much connection and authenticity. And I just love that so much.
Oh, I love that. That's a great answer. I love it. I always tell people there is no right or wrong answer. Sure. This is just what you feel you want to talk about. But I love it. I think it shows a little bit about what's important to everybody in their own.
Yeah, I bet it does.
Love that. Okay, Michael. So where can people find you if they want to connect with you? What are some services that you provide?
I love teaching and I love sharing ideas and I love discussing trauma and the Enneagram and therapy. And I do lots of that on my Instagram, which is Michael_Shahan_therapy. That's my handle. And then I have a Facebook as well, Michael_Shahan_MFT. That one's definitely not as active with other people. I post pretty much everything the same. So as long as you're on one, you're getting all the content. And then my website, michaelshahan.com. I have blogs and I have information on trauma and on EMDR. And I have everything that's on my, every series I've done on my Instagram, I also create like a PDF for it, like an ebook. And put on my website.
Awesome.
So just, I want people to be able to access that even if they don't know how to use Instagram well or whatever. So yeah, that's how you would find me, I think, if you wanted
to. That's so cool. And then you have the podcast coming up and the course. So once you have that, I'll go ahead and link that in the show notes for people to, you know, learn more about you.
And that's awesome.
Yeah. And that way, we can continue connecting people to, I agree with your brother. Like, you know your stuff.
Thank you. When I'm in a healthy place, I can agree with you. As a 9, when I'm unhealthy, it's like, I just convince myself that I don't know anything. But when I'm in a healthy place, I can look more like a 3 actually and think, you know what? I do have something to say. My voice matters. I can speak up about this. It's terrifying, but I'm getting way, way, way better at it the more I do it.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on this podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Cafe with Monica. If you enjoyed the episode, I want you to take a screenshot right now and share it on Instagram stories by tagging Cafe with Monica. This helps me spread the word so more and more people can hashtag just talk about it. Also, make sure to visit cafewithmonica.com to access the show notes and resources from this episode. I can't wait for you to listen to the next episode, so see you guys next time.